Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The recent impeachment case for President Donald Trump hinged on Ukraine. Did Trump extort from the president of Ukraine an announcement of an investigation into Joe and Hunter Biden in exchange for aid dollars that was needed to fight the Russian army that had invaded Ukraine? While this debate raged on, most Americans most likely don't know a whole lot about the Eastern European country of Ukraine and why it's become the center of these major stories. To help us understand Ukraine a little better, we're joined by Roman Papadouk, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine under President H.W. Bush. He currently serves as president of the Diplomacy Center Foundation, a nonprofit engaged with the State Department in building an American Diplomacy Museum at the State Department, as well as the chairman of the Board of Directors of the World Affairs Council of America.
There's actually a shooting war still going on between Ukraine and Russia. You know, a lot of people think there's a stalemate or a ceasefire. They've been speaking about that for ages, but on a daily basis, there are shootings across the border that separates the two sides at this stage of the game. Unfortunately, it's a situation that's really become very important, not only for Ukraine, but also for Western Europe, as well as for the United States. Ukraine is at the forefront of basically defending the concept of independence and democracy in that part of the world, and for the whole world. And for the United States, it's very important for us to lead in that position, because it shows the Europeans that we're behind Europe, we're behind Ukraine. Also, people forget that in the shooting war that's been taking place between Ukraine and Russia, the United States is very much heavily engaged in terms of giving advice and assistance. But it's also, Ukraine is at the forefront of actually interacting with Russia and seeing how their hybrid warfare acts and is carried out. And that's a learning lesson for us, the United States, because we obviously are not engaged, nor do want to be engaged in any active conflict with Russia. But Russia is a big power in that part of the world, and it's always good to know how their military operates, what kind of strategy they have, and what kind of tactics they follow through on. And they are using all kinds of tactics in that conflict, from outside of, you know, outright shootings every day to, you know, cyber warfare and all kinds of hybrid warfare. And we are learning the tactics and maneuvers that they engage in. That's a learning lesson for our military.
We're talking about Ukraine. It used to be we would always put the Ukraine. It would always be the was part of it. And now that's been dropped. Is that significant?
That's very significant for the Ukrainians, because when you use the article the Ukraine, for the Ukrainians, it signified that they're part of something. And historically, people saw Ukraine as being part of Russia. So you said the Ukraine, it kind of left that connotation in people's minds. They felt so they're very adamant that it should never be referred to as the Ukraine. It's simply Ukraine.
And the translation of Ukraine actually is borderlands.
Correct.
And so when we would call it the Ukraine, it was basically saying the borderlands. And they were always being fought over, squeezed, tugged apart, not really having a singular identity, which they're now trying to establish.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, David. If you look at it in terms of Ukraine's territory, it really has no natural boundaries in terms of high mountain ranges. You have the Carpathians, obviously, in the west, but it's open steppe. About two-thirds of the territory is open steppe and plains and the dark Chernozem soil, which is very good agriculturally. But as a result of that, the territory is kind of stuck between east and west. And a lot of conflicts, you know, the Tatar hordes came in the 13th century, and when the Nazis invaded, they came across Ukraine. So it's been caught between east and west, and as a result of that, it got divided. You had a western part of Ukraine that got controlled by Austria-Hungary until the end of the First World War, and then the eastern part, which was controlled by the Soviet government, and prior to that, by the Russian. By the Russian Tsar. So it's been kind of caught between East and West, and rightly so. Ukraine, therefore, means borderland, as you rightly pointed out.
Well, it's in the middle of Europe between the EU and Russia. It's also in the middle of a lot of global conflicts. Mm-hmm. It's very important that I think that we all have a better understanding of Ukraine and mm-hmm. Ukrainians, what their psychological identity looks like mm-hmm. right now. They are a country under siege.
Well, absolutely. And I think there's a lot of miscommunication or misunderstanding about Ukraine. There's always a feeling that there's a large contingent of Ukrainians that want to go back to Russia or identify as Russians. I think you have to stand back and look at the history of the situation. Yes, Ukraine was occupied, parts of Ukraine were occupied by Russians, and eventually, obviously, all of Ukraine was occupied by Russia in the 20th century. But if you look at the situation, Ukraine has a long tradition of democracy and individual freedom. And why do I say that? If you go back to the Cossack period of the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, if you look at those periods in the 16th and 17th centuries, you would see that the Cossack tradition of gathering at the siege, their headquarters on the Dnieper River, for example, they would elect their hetman, the head of the Cossack Brotherhood. And that was a democratic process. So the concept of democracy and the feeling of individual freedom is very strong among Ukrainians. And the other thing I would point to is like Taras Shevchenko, the national bard of Ukraine, the national poet, who is very strong in his writings about individual freedom and the need for Ukrainian independence. He was a poet of the 19th century in Ukraine. So that tradition and that culture has always been very strong among Ukrainians. I'll bring you up to the 20th century here, just to give you an indication about the sense of freedom and identity. When I served in Ukraine, for example, there was a movement for independence or greater freedom for Crimea. As we all know, Crimea has been in the news in the past few years when the Russians annexed it back in 2014. If you look at that situation, you will find that the Russian Duma, for example, is very adamant about claiming the rights to Crimea and Sevastopol.
Right, that is an area that is currently it's a territorial dispute. But it basically, the world recognizes that Crimea, the peninsula, has been stolen by Russia.
Correct. The Russians took it over after the 2013-2014 revolution in Ukraine, and they annexed it, as I mentioned. And but I'm bringing it back to when I was ambassador in the early 1990s, because the Russian attempts to stoke, foment problems in that area did not take hold. And so even though Crimea has a majority of ethnic Russians, even at that time the Russians weren't able to stoke any kind of problems in Crimea. And I mention that because also in 1991, when Ukraine declared independence, they made a contingent, or they had a referendum on independence in December of 1991. And about 91% of Ukrainians voted for independence, including the majority of ethnic Russians in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine in Donbas area.
Right, and that's significant because typically we see a very divided country. The east and west have very sort of different goals and identity. But it's about 17% of the population of Ukraine it identifies as ethnic Russian.
Correct, about 17% is ethnic Russian. But you have to be careful with that also, because almost all Ukrainians, no matter the ethnicity, speak Russian. And the intermarriage among the Russians and Ukrainians is very great. And so to say that 17% is ethnic Russians, correct, but their identity is still with Ukraine.
You were the first ambassador to Ukraine. Their constitution was minted in 1991.
Well, a little later than that, they had a constitution. I guess in the mid-90s or so, they had a new constitution that was put into place. I was the first ambassador. I served in 92 and 93. And it was quite interesting, both professionally and personally, to be engaged in that. Professionally, it was interesting because basically we had to stand up an embassy from scratch in terms of not only establishing the physical presence, but also establishing the personal contacts with the government and establishing a policy, a bilateral policy between our two nations, the U.S. and Ukraine. But personally, it was very, satisfying for me in the sense that I have Ukrainian roots. My parents came from Ukraine. I still have relatives in Ukraine. And to be able to visit the villages where my parents came from was very, very emotionally moving, and it was very historically significant for me to see, that someone that has roots in the country left and is able to come back and try to help the country, get on its feet as an independent state.
It's an emotional story. It's a part of World War II that a lot of people aren't familiar with. Can you talk about
that? Sure, absolutely. My parents were basically forced laborers when the Nazis came and the Germans came into Ukraine. They caught up a lot of young people and took them to Austria, Germany, the territories there. Both my parents wound up in Austria working. My mother was taken from her village when she was like 19 years old, and she was put to domestic work, working inside buildings. And my father worked outdoors on a farm, I think he was working. And what happened was that they were on two separate farms, so to speak. And eventually, you know, they would be able to socialize. People would get together, and that's how they met. They eventually married and stayed in Austria. And we were lucky enough that we were on the Western Zone, because after the war, a lot of people that were obviously on the Soviet side of the border were returned back to the Soviet Union. My parents were on the Western sector, so we were allowed to stay. And it was interesting because as we were in a refugee camp, a displaced persons camp, actually I was born in a DP camp. They were my parents and my older sister, Maria, who's passed away in the past few years, and myself there. And what happened was that my parents didn't know what to do in terms of resettlement, and they were happy enough staying in Austria. And someone came by one day and gave them an application to fill out, and it seems it was probably Ukrainian-American, that because the person spoke Ukrainian. And they filled out an application, and like a day or two later, some people came to the barracks where we were staying and says, pack up, you're heading out to the United States. And next thing you knew, you were on a train to Bremen, then on a ship that took us to Venezuela first, and then wound up in New Orleans. And we wound up being on a farm in Iowa, and Catholic Charities was our sponsor at that time. So it sounds very interesting, and it is interesting in that sense. But you know, David, that's a story that's a dime a dozen from that generation of East Europeans. Almost every East European immigrant has a similar story along the lines that I've just outlined to you. And that's the beauty of our country, the ability to come from, whether it was Eastern Europe or Latin America or any other part of the world, to come into the United States and build a life.
But I can't let that go without recognizing the fact that it's different now. We're not as welcoming to refugees as we had been.
I understand the point. I fully understand that. And I think we do need to have a situation where we welcome refugees. There probably has to be some kind of orderly process in the sense of how people get in, why they get in, and how they adapt into our society, and we facilitate that adaptation. But I, as a refugee, am definitely one for examining ways to be as open as possible, in the sense that it doesn't impact our, you know, national security or anything of that nature. That's I think, anyone that's been an immigrant or has immigrants from their side of the family, I think should understand that. And as I recounted my story, I'm very, very much sympathetic toward immigration.
So Ambassador Roman Papadukoiu, if you talk a little bit more about when you got back to Ukraine as the ambassador, and you have that story to tell, just in and of itself, having that narrative, here you are now the ambassador, the representative of the United States as this new country is crystallizing, that must have been a moment.
Oh, it definitely was. It was quite emotional. I remember when I got into the village that my father's from, they had a whole gathering in the central square. They sang songs. I met with the citizens, and I had my younger son Matthew with me for that trip, and I was able to stay with my cousins in their home, and to be able to see the lifestyle. And David, it's you have to go to a village like that to get an idea of what that country is all about and the old Soviet Union was all about. And you know, the old cliche, it was a third world country with nuclear weapons. I'm sure you've heard that. That's always referred to. And when you go to a village like that, you understand that. I remember staying in with my cousins in a nice house and all, but basically no indoor plumbing. You know, you'd have to use the, in the morning, I literally went out to a stump with a pail of water to shave and wash up. It was interesting because the houses are kind of small, and understandably, and you know, the living room served both as a living room and then a dining room, and at night it was my bedroom. It's interesting to see how people make use of everything that they have. But I tell you, the one thing that struck me about visiting with my father's family and then my mother's family also was, in any family in Ukraine, even strangers, is the hospitality of the people and their desire to integrate and to be Western. And so it was not only the hospitality on a personal basis, but the yearning to have the kind of the fruits of the benefits that the West had to offer and that the United States had to offer. And that was very touching to see, you know, what kind of symbol, what kind of beacon we, meaning the United States and the West in particular, offer people around the world.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm speaking with Roman Papaduk, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. We'll be right back. You're tuned to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. My guest this hour is Roman Papaduk, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And that's a central question about Ukraine as Ukraine is trying to decide what its future is going to be, whether it will be a Russia facing or whether it will be a European Union facing. And Putin, the strong man who runs Russia, certainly is not interested in losing Ukraine to Europe. He doesn't want to have the European Union at its border.
Yeah, that's a very valid analysis that you say, David. I have no doubts in my mind that Ukraine is facing Western, wants to go westward. If you look at if the economics is any indication of that, Russia used to be a main trading partner for Ukraine for obvious reasons, having been part of the Soviet Union, and their industries were very much tied, particularly in terms of heavy machinery and military equipment. But last year, people failed to realize that the leading trading partner, individual country for Ukraine now is not Russia, it's China. China is the leading bilateral trade partner for Ukraine. Poland and Germany are up there also, and Russia is like third or fourth at this stage. And about 40% of all trade now for Ukraine is with the EU countries. So they are moving west, and they're not part of the EU formally, by no means at this stage of the game, but all their interests and their trade are moving toward the West, and they're breaking off from Russia more and more. And that's an indication of how this country wants to move. And this goes back to something I said earlier, the tradition of Ukrainians for democracy, individual freedom, that's being lived out now and being parlayed and seen by the fact that they are now trading more and more with the West and integrating more with the West.
But to look at that and think about how trade is conducted, it seems as if, despite Putin's efforts, it's almost as if he's pushing Ukraine in a way into the West, because he's closed off the Black Sea to shipping. Mm. The eastern border is a war zone now. Mm. If you wanted to trade with Russia, you'd have a hard time.
Well, you're right in that sense, but I think going back to what you just mentioned about Putin, I think the greatest strength that the Ukrainians have is Putin, in the sense that, ironically, he's forcing them more into the Western mold than he would have thought to. I think Putin's strategy backfired. He figured that by invading Ukraine and by stoking some kind of discontent within the country would fall apart. As a matter of fact, what happened is the people have coalesced. Now see the Russians as enemies, not that they hate the Russians or anything in that sense, but you know, they see them as enemies, and are kind of struck that the Russians would actually attack them, and is making the Ukrainian people move more and more toward the West. And another thing in that equation, David, you have to realize that in the last 25 years, you have a whole new generation of young people who were born in an independent Ukraine. They have no concept of the old Soviet system and of the Russian hold and everything. And their concept when they came into their early 20s and mid-20s is Ukrainian-centric and Western-centric. And I've been to Ukraine many times. My last visit was in September of last year. And you meet with young people and you talk with them, and their whole vision is for building up their own businesses, for having freedoms to travel, for having an openness to the West, and there's very little talk about Russia. And the interesting thing about it, and this goes to the heart of the issue, I think, when we were talking earlier, is they speak Ukrainian and Russian, and they go from one language to the other, and they don't see that as a conflict. And we in the West somehow identify that if you speak Russian, then you're pro-Russian. That's not necessarily the case. And you'll find that with young people in Ukraine, a lot of them not only speak Ukrainian and Russian, but they speak English also. So they're very, very educated in that sense and very sophisticated.
One of the points I was trying to make just now is that we assign so much credit to Vladimir Putin that I don't think he actually deserves. I think that we've built him up to being this international zeitgeist boogeyman who seems to be pulling all the strings. But in many ways, he's just kind of stumbling around.
I think you have a very valid point there, specifically in terms of Ukraine. What I mentioned before is that he's actually been helpful to the Ukrainians, ironically, by the actions he's taken in terms of coalescing them. But on the broader issue, Putin has been successful. You know why, David? Because he hasn't been challenged. And one of the problems we have with democracy is democracies react very slowly. It's a time process in terms of decision making and how to do that. But in terms of his cyber war, in terms of his roles in Syria and all, he has not been challenged. So he's been basically filling a vacuum. But if he gets challenged in any way, I think he can fall like a, you know, very easily. There is no strength there because there's very little appeal that Russia can give to the outside world.
As we've learned more about Ukraine, it's become a big part of our national discussion. It obviously, it's part of the controversy with President Donald Trump. We've been hearing about the capital city and a discussion of the proper pronunciation, whether it should be Kiev or Kyiv.
Kyiv. Yeah.
All right. And so, and is that significant that we get that right?
Well, it's, you know, if you use a Texas twang, it's okay. You know, whether the pronunciation is for Ukrainians, Kiev is the pronunciation. That's how I pronounce it. Yeah. Are you going to Kyiv?
Am I going? Yeah. I would love to go.
I would strongly recommend you go. Kyiv is a very nice city, but two other cities you should mention. I'll mention here on your show are Lviv in Western Ukraine and Kharkiv. Those are three cities that you should visit.
All right, I'll try to make a point of it. Right now, I'm lucky if I can get to Poteet. We're taking a break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. When we come back, more with Roman Papadouk, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast comes from Sunshine Cottage's Noche del Sol, a fiesta kickoff event with Mexican food, entertainment, and Delaritas, plus a raffle and auctions to benefit the School for Deaf Children, March 26th, 6 p.m. More at sunshinecottage.org.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Why is Ukraine at the center of an international struggle with Russia? How important is it that America fully maintains its foreign service? And how corrupt is Ukraine really? I'm speaking with Roman Papadouk, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Now, you're the national leader of the World Affairs Council. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about what the World Affairs Council, why it's important that we have these gatherings of individuals who support international dialogue and understanding and a support of foreign policy that embraces diplomacy. Mm-hmm. In the context of what's happening with Ukraine, talk about why foreign policy, why having skilled diplomats on the ground such as yourself, why was that important?
Sure. Let me divide the question into two parts, the World Affairs Council and the specific one about foreign service and diplomacy. I'm glad you mentioned, you know, that I serve as chairman, national chairman of the World Affairs Councils of America, so that your audience knows that is a organization that has about 90 active councils in across about 40 states or so. Basically, the San Antonio Council, which I'm visiting during this trip, is a very active council. And the whole purpose of the World Affairs Councils of America is to bring the story of foreign policy basically to the kitchen table for average Americans around the country in all communities to be able to have a dialogue about foreign policy issues and to understand those foreign policy issues. What the councils do is bring in speakers to discuss contemporary foreign affairs issues. They hold conferences. We hold a conference on a national level every year in November in Washington, D.C., where all council members and general public are invited to attend. And we bring a very high-level speakers to those conferences. For example, last November, we had former Secretary of State James Baker address the council in D.C. So that opens up a dialogue for Americans to understand why foreign policy is important. How it impacts individual states, how it impacts our society in general. And so I think that's very important for us to continue in that role. In terms of diplomacy, a very legitimate point, David, technology has changed dramatically over the years, and it's impacted all sectors of our society, including diplomacy. You know, 100 years ago, you had to take a boat to, to send an emissary with a message or something across the ocean. Now you can pick up the telephone, and within a nanosecond, you're speaking with a foreign leader. So the technology has impacted the way diplomacy can be carried out. But there are two things that diplomacy still maintains that will never really change, and those are, one, personal contact, and two, expertise. And so diplomacy, in particular here in the case of the Foreign Service at the State Department, is key, because you have to build those personal relationships for understanding and to be able to communicate. And the Foreign Service, in its daily work, both at the State Department, through the State Department, as well as through its embassies in the various countries, builds those personal relationships. The second thing that the Foreign Service brings to the table is expertise. You have people that speak the languages and therefore can build on that communication and that personal relationship, but also understand the issues, whether they're economic, whether they're political, whether they're social, to help our government understand how to develop and devise policies to strengthen the bilateral relationship or to build coalitions. So that understanding of the cultures and that understanding of the specific issues is something that the Foreign Service brings to the table. And irrespective of the role of technology, how it evolves, those two ingredients will continue to be very strong features of the Foreign Service.
Having a fully functional State Department with lifelong professionals, they're not partisans, who are patriots, who are looking out for the best interest of the United States, our Constitution, and the spreading of freedom and the protection of human rights around the world. And it seems like in this current administration, it doesn't get the credit or the funding or the support that it ought to have.
I think to a certain extent, let me address the issue in this way. It's a very valid point that you make in certain respect, but there are two things I'd like to separate the question on. One, it kind of relates to technology or the fast-paced nature of the world that we have now. And that is, I've served in two White Houses, under President Reagan in his second term and under President Bush, 41. And I've noticed, obviously that decision-making in crises is centralized. And as a result of that, it becomes more and more centralized in the White House and the National Security Council. And as a result of that, cabinet agencies are kind of left in the background at times because of the nature of the decision-making that takes place. I'm not making an excuse of it. I'm just kind of outlining the nature of the beast, so to speak, that we have in the contemporary world. And so what you see a lot of what's going on now is the centralization in the White House because of the fast-paced nature of the world and the decision-making that takes place. The second part in terms of the expertise, I think you're absolutely right. This goes back to the heart of the matter. They mentioned that the Foreign Service gives you, the personal relationships and the expertise to deal with issues. The one thing I would say in terms of the current situation, David, that we've all lived through in terms of the impeachment of the president and in terms of the controversies about Ukraine that we heard over the past few months, is that irrespective of what side of the aisle you fall on politically, I think one of the drawbacks of the whole process was the questioning of the nature and the commitment of the State Department personnel. People at the State Department, at the Foreign Service officers, and even the civil service employees that work in the foreign affairs field, they come to the table with a commitment to serve any administration, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. They're professionals. They serve at the pleasure of the president, and they serve the president. So they don't look at it in terms of politics. And to have questioned the commitment of these people, the patriotism of these people, I think was an unfounded, was unfounded, and it was erroneous. These people are committed patriots. I firmly believe a lot of the people that testified on the Hill regarding the impeachment hearing from the career service and the same amount of people that I know personally, and I've known them to be very good individual officers and servants in the foreign affairs field. So I think one thing that troubles me about this whole process, David, is that there could be a feeling in the general public that as they watch this unfold, this that somehow there are people in the government that are anti-government, and I would caution the public to take a closer look at the situation. I, having been a Foreign Service officer myself, served under Republican and Democratic presidents, and our role was to carry out the policies of the president and to serve the president, to serve the nation. And I fully believe that my colleagues did that properly. And so I think that in the short term, the Foreign Service might have taken a little bit of a black eye because of this controversy. But I think, you know, these professionals will get through this. And I think the general public will realize, you know, the commitment and the work that these people undertake.
But having an individual like President Trump's unpaid personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, going into Ukraine and making inquiries and talking about conspiracies and serving the president on one channel but not really working through the State Department, that seems pretty unorthodox.
Well, I think it's kind of unorthodox in terms of what transpired now. I know presidents in the past have had personal emissaries for particular issues overseas, you know, a negotiator for this or a negotiator for that. But that's all been in the public domain, you know, and so I'm not, and I think, you know, if you look at your history, we've done that. That's not to excuse what happened here. I think the situation with the Giuliani case is the fact that it was tied in with politics, apparently, you know, at home. And that's the problem with this particular situation, I think, and Julie, that it looks like it might have overstepped the bounds of a personal emissary on a policy issue. It turned out to be a political issue.
Corruption in Ukraine has come up a lot, and we do understand that Ukraine has a history of public corruption, but who doesn't? What country does not? You know, the United States went through a period like that. It was all part of the maturation of a country and establishing a rule of law. But what is your understanding of like the level of corruption in Ukraine?
Corruption is very high in Ukraine. I'll be perfectly honest with you on that one. But I'm not saying anything, nor are you saying anything that I think a lot of people are not aware of. Unfortunately, you know, corruption is very prevalent in Ukraine. And that's, you know, it's an outgrowth of the old Soviet system, and it's going to take a while to get rid of it. You know, during the Soviet system, you were able to survive by being corrupt, basically, by skimming off of the top, by taking some extra spare parts or this or that in order to survive as an individual or to have your family survive and to get ahead. So that tradition kind of continued, and the biggest corruption is in the judicial system in Ukraine. And that is not only a detriment to the proper functioning of the society, but it's also an economic problem for Ukraine, because a lot of businesses do not want to function in an environment where there's corruption. You don't know how legitimate your contract is going to be after you sign it and whether it will be carried out or not. You know, businessmen are willing to take the business risk, but they're not willing to take the political risk. You know, you could understand that your widgets may not be as good as the guy next door, you know, when he comes in when you're competing. But to see that your widgets can't get into market because the other guy paid a higher bribe or paid a bribe and you don't want to pay a bribe, that's a whole different situation. And so Ukraine has a lot to do in terms of getting rid of its corruption on the judicial level. That's a key point for them. And that's something that we, meaning the United States, as well as international associations like, you know, the IMF, have been pushing the Ukrainians on to get their house in order on the judicial side in order to get rid of corruption.
So to have an efficient anti-corruption officer in Ukraine, that's the prosecutor,
the general prosecutor.
And that's what former Vice President Joe Biden was accused of doing, is improperly trying to get the prosecutor fired. And the conspiracy is that he was doing that in order to help his son Hunter. But internationally, looking at this, knowing the perspective of everything that's involved, that this was really about trying to help Ukraine deal with its corruption.
Yeah. Without getting into the Biden issue. The general, you're on the right track in the sense that the international community as a whole has been addressing the issue of corruption in Ukraine and making sure that the judges are vetted properly, that the system operates properly. That's been a key aspect of Western discussion with Ukraine. So, without getting to the specifics of the Biden case, I think it's fair to say that the Western community as a whole, the donors in terms of, the international financial institutions that have supplied the funds to Ukraine, as well as individual supporters like the United States, have been key in talking to the Ukrainians on rectifying the judicial system and the way the judges are vetted, the way the judges are appointed, who are selected as judges, and how the judges carry out their duties. That's been a key part for the discussions between the West and Ukraine.
And the current president, Zelensky, he was a comedian, an actor, and he was elected on an anti-corruption platform. And he dissolved the parliament and re-elected the parliament, which came along trying to also pass new laws. They were passing them pretty lickety-split, pretty quick, trying to deal with corruption overall and corruption in the parliament.
Yeah, absolutely. Zelensky came in, I think he won 73% of the vote, which is an astounding percentage, for a novice politician. He came into the office with three goals: one, to end the war with Russia; two, to end corruption; and three, to have economic reform. Not necessarily in that order, but those were the three points of his platform. And he came in with like 73% of the vote. And then when they had the parliamentary vote, his party won an outright majority, the first time in Ukraine's history that a single party gained full control of the parliament. So he has a huge mandate, both in terms of his own personal victory as well as his party's victory in the parliament. Unfortunately, the sense of governing has struck him now, and he's realized the difficulties that are involved in governing. And I think just the other day, his cabinet was dismissed, and he's going to be getting a whole new cabinet. And part of the reasons for that, I think, is he's learning that a lot of the people he may have appointed cannot really carry out the administrative challenges, that are facing the country, I think. And so a lot of the people that he appointed were totally new to government. They brought a lot of, desire to change. But I think he found also that a lot of them did not have the skills to carry out these functions. And so he's kind of reshuffling the chessboard a little bit now to get some other people in that might have a little bit more experience. But I think his commitment is very strong. I tell you, when I was in Ukraine in September, I didn't meet with him personally, but I saw him give a talk, and I was there, and I was impressed by President Zelensky. He seems like a very bright individual, very articulate, and able to think on his feet, and committed to his country, and to get in the process moving along the lines that he outlined in his campaign. But the realities of governing, just like here in the United States or in any country, you make all kinds of commitments, and then you come in, and then the reality of governing is there, and you just have to make some adjustments. And I think what you're seeing right now is that he's making those adjustments.
It's always been really hard for me to kind of draw a bead on what exactly the policy is with the Trump administration in regards to Crimea. Mm-hmm. And is the Trump administration on solid ground and says full-throatedly that Crimea belongs to Ukraine and not Russia?
Oh, yeah. I think we're very much in unison with the rest of the international community in terms of condemning the Russian action and underscoring that Crimea is part of Ukraine. I don't think that's ever been a question for us. But if you look at the subsequent role of the administration in terms of its relationship with Ukraine, it's been fairly good in the sense that, and I would point to three things. Number one, the sanctions that President Obama put in place remain in place and actually have been increased in some instances against the Russians. Secondly, the administration did sell the Javelin missiles, provide the Javelin missiles to Ukraine.
These are anti-tank.
Anti-tank, correct. And thirdly, which was kind of good, I thought, was Kurt Volker was appointed as I don't want to use the word intermediary, but as an observer or participant in the peace negotiations that were taking place, or the discussions that were taking place between the Russians and the Ukrainians and with Germany and with France. And that was very important to have a U.S. presence there, because it showed our keen interest in having that issue settled amicably. So there were certain strengths that were
brought
to the
table. And I'm aware
of
all those things, and that's why you know, I see other things like Donald Trump being reluctant to actually sign bills passed by Congress to put sanctions on Russia. He waits until the very last minute to do so, and he expresses things that in support of Russia. And so you kind of wonder, is he you really have to be very careful in dealing with Russia. We don't want Ukraine to turn into the trigger for another massive hot war with Russia, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Nobody wants, first of all, no one wants American boots on the ground there. That's the first thing. And no one wants an expanded war. You know, the preference, obviously, is to be able to settle this as amicably as possible. And that's why it was very good to have a U.S. presence involved in that. And say, Kurt, you know, obviously resigned, Kurt Volker resigned from his position in the wake of all these Ukraine issues that developed in our Congress. And as far as I know, no one's been named to replace him, and I think that's a weak point. You know, if I were having any influence in the administration, I would strongly urge that a new person be appointed so that we can be part of the process and make sure that the Russians realize that we're vested in having a peaceful outcome to this.
Taking one last break, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Roman Papadouk is here. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Let's get back to the interview with former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Roman Papadouk. While we don't want to have boots on the ground, we may want to have the wingtips. We want wingtips on the ground that diplomats typically wear. Yeah. Talk about what diplomacy, soft power, can do so we don't get into these terrible wars.
Sure. No, in Ukraine in particular, I think it's very important. We don't have an ambassador yet in Ukraine. You know, when
Taylor.
When Taylor left in early January, I think it was. But, you know, we haven't had an ambassador since Yovanovitch left, Maria, you know, left last May, I think.
She was forced
out. Yeah, when she left in May, we haven't had a permanent ambassador. I mean, Bill came in as a chargé d'affaires and stayed on through December or January, I think it was. And so we don't have anyone named as an ambassador. That's an awfully long time. But I think that's probably par for the course for the administration, because there are so many positions in government that are still, you know, kind of left empty, I think so. But that's not good. I would prefer to see an ambassador named as quickly as possible, a new ambassador, because that underscores our commitment to the country. In terms of what the Foreign Service could do, and, you know, it's not limited to Ukraine at all. I mean, you need to recruit. Let's put it this way, David. Starting with recruitment, our service needs to be as diverse as possible to reflect the American public. Okay, and that's both, you know, ethnic as well as gender diversity, because that signifies to the rest of the world the immigrant roots of our nation and the strength of our nation in terms of people being able to build a nation from a diverse field of backgrounds. And I think a lot of people kind of look upon our country as a symbol of that, and quite frankly, we'd like to emulate that. So I think the type of recruitment we have is very, very important. I think it's also important that our diplomats continue in the two roles that I mentioned at the outset of our conversation. They can help build a peaceful world by developing the communication with their host governments, not only with the governments, but with the peoples. It's important that the Foreign Service get out into the field as much as possible, not just deal with the government officials in the capital. I tell you, when I served as ambassador, the two points that I would make in terms of the best feedback that I got in many cases was that the Peace Corps volunteers were very beneficial in spreading the image and the concept of America and the idea of democracy, because they're out in the villages. And some of the best feedback I got on what's going on in the country was from the businessmen, because business people would go to any nook and cranny in a country to see if they could establish a presence in business to sell their widgets or whatever, or buy widgets or whatever it is. And so I had a very small staff, so we couldn't really do that, you know, in Ukraine at that time, because we were just standing up the embassy. But that's a feature of any embassy, to be able to get out there and get those roots established for the American presence, and to get that feedback from the people. And that also carries over into having a foreign service that is very much expert. They know the culture, they have their fingers to the wind, they know which way the political situations go, so they could give a heads up to our government. If we have those three things, the symbolism of American culture and our presence in terms of our diversity, our communications with the grassroots of a country as well as the host government, and the expertise of the Foreign Service in terms of the knowledge of what's going on in the ground, you put that together, I think you have a very, very strong Foreign Service that serves this country very, very ably.
When I grew up, it was like the Foreign Service. I mean, you had to be smart as a whip. And
oh, thank you.
You know, I mean, you really speak multiple languages and test very well and show up on time and wear clean clothes to be part of the Foreign Service. All the things I could not do. Are young people today, are they thinking about Foreign Service as a call, as a vocation?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think there's such a draw into the Foreign Service as there was in the old days, so to speak. And I don't want to date myself or anything here, but I think our society offers so many opportunities now in terms of, you know, jobs and things of that nature, you know, career paths, that I think, and the fact that the, you know, what governments become in Washington, very, you know,
but we need partisan, good. We need these, you know, good people.
Very partisan. That I think a lot of the luster may have gone off of the Foreign Service, and that's unfortunate. I know at the State Department we try to make a great effort to recruit, you know, people as much as possible, to get the people in. But it's a great career. I would have to, if I could make a pitch on your show right now, it's a great career. It's a very rewarding career professionally and personally in terms of the experiences that you get and the friendships that you establish.
And also the work that you can do.
Oh, it's the work that you can do. The fact that you're able to go overseas and represent the American people and actually have an impact by what you report is very satisfying professionally.
And make the world a better?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Just by your presence. Let me just tell your audience this. I don't think, maybe the audience, many members in the audience may not realize the great respect that people have for the United States and how they love the United States. And the fact that you can go overseas and carry that message overseas, that we want to work with people and that we want to bring the values that we've espoused historically and work with them so they can establish the same kind of country. I'm not saying that you know, everyone has to emulate us, but people do want basic things like freedom, you know, human rights, the chance to develop their businesses, for their kids to get educated, etc. So those are values that we have here in this country, and a lot of people aspire to those values and look to the United States to carry that forward. You know, I mean, that's something I think a lot of Americans don't realize. And as a Foreign Service officer, when you go overseas and you're carrying that message in itself, before you even get down into the policy issues, that's a big strength that we have as a country.
Roman Papaduk is the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He currently serves as president of the Diplomacy Center Foundation. It's a nonprofit engaged with the State Department in building an American diplomacy museum at the State Department. Also, he is the chairman of the board of directors of the World Affairs Council of America. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.